Hello, men. Welcome to what I believe is the fourth week now in our Help, I'm Under Attack series. This morning we're going to look at, what is at times a controversial topic? Even I was not as aware, perhaps as I should have been, of how underappreciated men sometimes feel. As if what they do doesn't matter, as if their role is not distinctive or unique enough that it really makes a contribution. As a matter of fact, in recent years there have even been some books written on the topic of the underappreciated male and what is the role of men. And it's actually been a topic that's been visited a number of times based on the idea that researchers already understand men feel underappreciated, and many in society question what is the role of men, what is the value of men. And so I think that this morning, if you listen along to the discussion that we have, you're going to gain some new insights. What I suggested to our men on Saturday morning, I'm going to suggest to any of you that are listening along. This is a great episode to listen to with your wife. Maybe pause it up a number of times and actually have some discussion on some of the points, especially toward the end, where we talk about the differences between men and women. The beginning part, where you introduce some of the lead-up, the history that leads us to where we are today, you might find that helpful as well for the two of you to listen to, maybe discuss a little bit. Things that maybe will be helpful for you to discuss with your children at an age-appropriate way. So, as always, I hope that you're blessed and encouraged by this. We do put a lot of effort into trying to bring you timely, relevant information that can help you to live out your faith commitment a week at a time. And so I do truly hope that you're encouraged by this, guys. See you again next week. Oh, you're probably going to regret showing up this morning because this is going to be one of the deepest sessions that we've done in a while. There are three pages of material. And two of them are double-sided. So.
Sorry, it's still early.
All right, so I asked these guys to move front, and that wasn't just to make room for you, Greg, to sit in the back. Would you move up a little bit, man? No, you don't have to. So the topic for the morning is the push for a more gender-neutral society. In other words, and this has actually been the topic of a number of books within the past 5 to 6 years. Do men really matter? Is there a role for men? Now, I suppose that you think that because you're here, you already know the answer and you already know what I'm going to tell you, but what if that's not entirely true? And what I'm going to suggest is men the way men used to be may not matter anymore, when culture is the way culture is. The role of women in the last 100 years has changed drastically. I mean, if you think back here, most of you, I'm sure, are aware of the fact that like 70 years ago, yesterday or something, was D-Day celebration, right? Most of you heard that. Okay, 70 years ago, how long does that feel? Right, a long time. Okay, it's not that much before that that women didn't even have the right to vote in this country. So just keep that in mind. One of the things that they say when they study groups of people is it takes about 3 generations for a complete change to take place. So the best way to understand this, and I told you this is going to be deep, and for a little while you're going to ask yourself, why am I here and what does this have to do with things? But here's my premise, and I'll tell you this right up front, that if you want to be a responsible male in the 21st century, you're going to have to understand how to fill that role, and you're going to have to understand how things got to where they are today. Now, I'm just going to give you a very brief overview, and it's going to go so fast that it might feel like as if you don't get much out of it. That's why there's notes here. More than that, I'm actually going to ask that you might, if you have a wife or a significant other, this will be uploaded within a day or two. I'm going to ask that you go back and listen to this with her. and that you together discuss some of the things that we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to start on the page with the pretty chart on the front. But don't look at the chart yet, because you're going to draw all the wrong conclusions about the chart. Well, anyway, back to the three generations. So it takes about three generations for complete adjustment to take place. So if we look at groups of people that have emigrated to this country, so that could be Irish, it could be Italian, it could be people from the Pacific Rim, it could be like a Vietnamese population was a great one after the war there ended, that there was a large population of Vietnamese that came to this country. And you can look at an outside group of people and watch how they adapt to a new culture and how long it takes. So the first generation that comes across, they're set in their ways. They don't change. If it is absolutely essential, they make some minor adjustments for the sake of survival. They'll learn to speak the language of the country they live in simply so they can survive. They'll adapt to some of the customs because they're forced to. I mean, in our country, work is done according to the customs of our culture. And so people work at certain times, they take off at certain times. That may be completely foreign to somebody from a different culture, but they will adapt only because they have to. And one of the reasons they don't adapt is, first, they don't know how, they're not comfortable with adapting. Just remember that. They don't know how and they are not comfortable. You could actually write that down somewhere because it'll apply later on. The second thing is that they feel that they would be untrue to who they are. I'll bet you probably need some pens, which I neglected to ask if you needed. So, I don't know. Here, somebody be in charge of the pen ministry this morning. Thank you. All right, so second generation, if they are born in this country, they start to adapt. They're stuck, they're pulled in two different directions. And you know what I'm talking about. It's the group of people that they talk one language at home and they go out into culture and they go out into society and they talk a different language. Now, some make the change easy, some make the change difficult. So for instance, the first generation may insist, in the home we're going to speak the language of the country that we came from, because if we don't, we're going to forget and we're going to get lost into this new population and we'll be forgotten forever. And the flip side of that is that in some families, the first generation will say, no, I want you to be fully integrated into this new society, so I want you to learn the language. Let's say by the third generation, apart from physical characteristics that distinguish, say, an Asian from a European, you really can't tell the difference. They've pretty much integrated fully into the culture, so it takes about three, perhaps sometimes four generations for a change to take place. Now, this is important for us as guys to understand because there has so much that has changed in our own country. There's so much that has changed about the roles of men and women and what men are good for, or sometimes, as is viewed by some people, not good for. Do men even have a function and a role here? And if they do, what is it? All right, so the reason that I put this cute little thing here, this cute little chart on the front page, is for us to take a snapshot view of who we are and where we are. Now, these statistics are the ones that people hear. The percentage of kids born outside of a marriage. And look at the way it's divided up. White people, 29%, all races, 40%. Look at where the black people are. Now, have you ever seen this or heard this statistic or something similar to it? And what is the conclusion that is usually drawn? Well, come on, draw the conclusion. Huh? Yeah, a lot of them, right? Well, what might you draw a conclusion of? That
black people don't get married.
Yeah, black people don't get married. Black people are irresponsible. Black people have no morals. Black people are, you know, I go on. I mean, and a lot of people use this statistic. Well, when you dig a little deeper, what you find is, how many of you have heard this statistic? The odds of being a young black person and being incarcerated are five times as great as those of being a young white person and being incarcerated. The odds of living in the same neighborhood even and being a black person and being incarcerated are five times as likely. In other words, there are other mitigating factors. Here's another couple that we can introduce. I read a secondary article in The Atlantic that kind of like brought some of these statistics to light. And the writer didn't dispute this figure. It's really hard to dispute. It's pretty much a black and white stat. But what he said is this. In large part, one of the problems is that the number of married people in black society that have kids has gone down significantly. This is a, if you wanted to be fair about this, what you'd really say if you wanted to offset this statistic and make it more like the white people is, what you'd have to do is tell black people that were married to have more kids. He said, there's a problem with that though, because a lot of black people live below the poverty line and they already know they can't have more kids. They can't afford the kids they have, so why in the world would they have more?
You're responsible like the rest of them.
You know, it's good to see you, but it would be good to see you silent for a while. So my point here is this. When you and I look at statistics, it's important that we grasp the full picture before we jump to conclusions. There are a lot of mitigating factors that contribute to why this statistic or these statistics are what they are. And yet, can we all agree that they're unacceptable? I mean, even if we go all the way down to the low end, which is just under a third of all white children are born into a situation where the couple isn't married. Would we call that a very acceptable statistic? Now, here's the thing. Believe it or not, there's a large block of society that would say it's not a big deal. Now, why wouldn't it be a big deal? Because we all know this statistic, in all likelihood, who is going to have primary custody of a child? Right. Now, there are exceptions to that. There are actually exceptions to that in this room. But in the majority of cases, a mother is going to have primary custody. Now, if men are already seen as being marginalized and questionable, and people literally write books about, is there a role for men? And if there is, we need to help men understand what their role is. That's indicative of how far that we have changed. I'm not going to say slip, I'm just going to say change. When it takes experts to write books to tell us why we're here and what our role should be, I'd say we're in trouble. Have you ever felt as if either you didn't understand why you were here or more to the point that others have questioned why you were here? Have you ever been made to feel like a less than contributing father, husband, employee, whatever it is? Yeah. So what I'd like to do, this is going to be encouraging, but we're going to have to wade through some ugly stuff till we get to the other side. So what I need you to do is just track with me for a while so we understand how we got here, and then we'll get to the encouraging part. But if you jump ship in the middle, it's on you, and you're just going to be lost in your own mire of depression. I just want to tell you that. First thing, there is an awareness. Let's just get this on the table right away. There is a growing awareness that men are absolutely essential for the healthy development of a child. And one of the primary reasons for marriage as a God-ordained institution, we're going to get into that later on. One of the primary reasons for marriage is to produce, as the scripture says, godly offspring. In other words, to raise up, to grow up children that are well-balanced, well-adjusted, and ready to face adulthood with the greatest likelihood of success. Isn't that what every one of us wants as parents? Well, for a number of years, there was some question as to whether men actually played much of a role in that. And what's being discovered more and more is that there are distinct differences between the genders, and the gender differences matter. So here's the way a neurologist described this. Somebody who is a neuroscientist says, within seconds of putting all the probes onto a human brain so that you can scan, do a brain scan, within seconds you can tell if it's male or female. So one woman said, I don't even need to walk into the room where the patient is. They could be patient X. You flip the switch and I can tell male or female. It's that pronounced. It's that different. So if you've ever said to yourself, and this is something of a joke, men and women think differently, well, yes, it's very, 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 very true. So true that our brains literally are composed differently. They function differently. The halves of the brains interact with each other differently. Men are different. The differences matter. That's the assessment of, and I'm going to use this word, secular researchers. Okay, that doesn't make them bad. It just means that their bias is not toward advancing a religious cause. At the same time, in this country, there is another whole substantial, influential group of people that says gender doesn't matter. Now, if you want the proof for that, this is going to sound a little bit negative, so you're just going to have to be patient and work with me. Would you champion and advance the cause of two people of the same sex getting married and adopting kids if you knew that a child and believed that a child would not be as well-balanced, well-adjusted, and ready to face adulthood? Would you intentionally champion that cause if you knew that the child would end up as an adult disadvantaged by the process? You wouldn't do that. As a matter of fact, you'd put your foot down and you'd say, "Are you nuts? Don't you think we have enough problems in this country without creating an environment where we can foster child development that's going to create even more problems in the next generation? Why would we do that?" And yet we're doing it. And so what I've concluded, and I really mean this, it's as if we have two different groups of people thinking two different thoughts, and they don't look at what the other one is thinking, and they don't evaluate what the other one is thinking, and nobody bothers to ask the question. So are we as a country intentionally blind? Are we just stupid? Reserve your comments on that. Or is there a real spiritual war that's going on? Now, I'm going to leave that for now up to you to judge. But I want to repeat this. There is an ample already and mounting body of evidence that suggests that men contribute substance and significance into the child development years. Without which the child, and yes, there are many compensating factors, but without which the child is more likely to reach adulthood with less than what they could in the way of coping skills and success-related skills built into them. Mounting body of evidence that it matters, and yet at the same time, we're moving in a direction where we say that it doesn't matter who raises you or why or how. Now, how can that be? Well, I see I've hit a button there. Here's the thing. If we want to make a difference, and we're not going to make a difference in certain circles, if you want to make a difference in your sphere of influence, you can no longer remain ignorant of how we got here, why we are here, and what needs to be done. So if you want to be a guy that makes a difference, you have to start with the work that nobody seems to like to do, which is you've got to really do the digging to find out how in the world did we get where we are. And how we got where we are is not all bad. But it is the tendency of human beings to advance technology before they understand how to manage it. So we get weapons before we know morally how to use them. We get chemicals before we know the negative side effects. We grow food using certain things before we fully understand the consequences downstream. It is the story of human history that we champion advancement in certain things without understanding the consequences that we're going to reap later on. And only then, later on, do we start to figure out how to manage the consequences of what we've sowed. Do you understand what I'm saying? It is just that way with humans, and it's nothing new, and it's nothing new to this situation right here. So here it is, and you've heard me talk about this. Got to move fast. We're going to go through these bullet points. There was a time when agriculture occupied the bulk of the economy in this country, when most people were small farmers or shopkeepers, when a man and his wife and his kids, they grew up, they did stuff together, and it's like the Waltons on steroids, you understand the deal, it was all happy and everything. Well, I mean, it really basically sucked, and nobody wants to go back to that. I'm not saying, oh, we should all go back to living in a two-room dirt shack, and Ma and Pa should go out and till the field with a mule, and they should scratch out a living because the kids were healthy and happy then. Because the kids were sick then, there was a lot of starvation, it wasn't good. I'm not saying that we want to go back. I'm saying we just need to look at what we do now that we're ahead, because you can't put the genie back in the box anyway. But think about this. The child was under the influence of both parents who were committed to staying together and frankly needed to stay together. The man had a clear role. Much work was physical. How many of you do physical work for a living? Okay. Talking to the wrong crowd here. Nobody gets it. A larger and larger swath of the American population, advanced civilization's population, does not do work that requires brute force. Even in what you do. Have you ever studied how steel used to be erected? Have you ever seen old pictures, right? There's a big difference, right? The hydraulic crane didn't used to pull up to the job site and lift 50 pieces of steel in a few hours. There was a huge and monumental amount of effort. And a guy was very much respected. Not in all circles, but a guy had a distinct role. There was certain work that only men could do. 80 years ago, could you have seen putting women in the military? In any kind of a forward position? As anything but a nurse or something, or an administrative assistant, you wouldn't have done that. That's just an example. So there were roles that were clearly defined. A man did these things. A man was the hero in certain circumstances. And men were powerful and women were feminine. And there was a clear divide. But things aren't that way anymore. And again, I'm not saying we take it back to that. But here's what's happened. Women have advanced and men have become confused. I don't know who I am anymore. I used to have an identity. Do you remember the number of weeks that we talked about finding who you are in Christ? I want to tell you, this matters. It matters in very practical ways, because if you allow society to define who you are as a man, you're in some muck, buddy. You really are. Because as society redefines who a man is, they don't have a real clear definition. They're struggling with a definition. How would you like to go through your whole life and not know who you are? And I think those of you in this room kind of know who you are, so you don't necessarily appreciate fully the dilemma of the guy who you work next to who doesn't have any idea what his identity is. So without going into all the details, here's what's happened. We got two world wars take place in the last century. Most healthy, able-bodied young men go off to war. Who does that leave to fill the factories? Women. For probably the first time in their lives, large blocks of women discover they can do this. They can kind of do the same thing that men did. Not only that, they get a paycheck. Don't minimize that. There is a certain amount of financial independence that women have. And it's only a little while before that, remember, that they weren't even allowed to vote. This is huge. And keep in mind, it is men that kept them in a position of not voting. Remember, several generations, it's only 1920 that women got the right to vote in this country. Is it any wonder that there is turmoil and difficulty? And guess whose fault it was in the minds of women that women didn't have the right to vote? Was it other women who caused that to happen? No. There's a little bit of intergenerational ill will. All right, so those are some financial situations. So women discovered that they could work. Women discovered that independent of men, they could survive. They could bring home a paycheck. And in addition to that, those who had children at home, what did they do at the end of the day? They went home and cared for their kids. And so here is the way one sociologist summed it up. There was a time in our country where for the average family, a man was the provider and he was the kingpin outside the home. And the woman took care of the home. Incidentally, we're going to look in a little while at why the home is the woman's domain. He said, what's happened is this. Women now earn, we'll say, half of the income in a working family. So a man is no longer the provider. He only plays 50 or 60% of the provision role. And at the same time, he's only half the role at home. How many of you feel like you are in control at home? You're the only one who lives there.
That's great.
All right. Now we're going to take a look at, I mentioned the war before. And I know this is a complex collection of stuff. But God has clearly defined some roles. If you go back to the scripture, there are some clearly defined roles. There are some things that are expected of men. But there's another transition that has taken place significantly in the past 150 years. We go back 150 years and there was a significant rise in what we'll call a humanist movement. Does anybody know what a humanist is? A humanist essentially is someone who seeks to explain the way life is without any originations in a divine being. Everything has a natural cause. Now there's some good components to a humanist movement. In other words, we don't any longer say, well, I guess God caused the rain. Now, I'm not saying that God can't cause rain, but today we have a pretty clear understanding of when it's going to rain and why it's going to rain. As a matter of fact, we build our lives around it. If you do outside work, you plan your day or your week around the fact that we have discovered what makes it rain and when. And so we can predict that in advance. Imperfectly, admittedly, but we can still try to predict it. So there are some good elements to the idea of not saying, well, God just magically makes everything happen. But taken to an extreme, the humanist movement says that there is no divine being, that there is nothing but a naturalistic explanation. Now, it wouldn't have gained a lot of traction except for two significant world wars and all of the collateral damage that occurred there. And it happened first in Western Europe. So suppose that in the span of 30 or 40 years, you and yours were the victims of two significant wars. You watched entire cities be firebombed. You saw millions of people slaughtered. You witnessed the dropping of a nuclear bomb. And you started to ask the question, could there possibly be a God that would allow all of this stuff to happen? Now remember, our homeland was kept safe. So our men went off to fight, but our families were essentially secure and safe here on this soil. But if you were a European and you watched your wives, your children, your best friends all die in a war and thought, this will never happen again. And then only a short time later, it happened again. You'd start to have some serious questions about whether there was a God. And that's what happened. And so people who said, we need to look for naturalistic explanations, gained real traction when people who were the victims of two successive wars said, how could there possibly be a divine, all-powerful, good being that would allow all this stuff to happen? And at the same time, science helps them gain traction because there's greater and greater explanatory power in science. We can look at how, why you are the way you are, why your head's shaped the way it is, why your hair color is the way it is. We can trace that right back to your genes. And so we understand that there are very real natural causes for why you are the way you are and who you are. Great, thank you. You're my hero. There's a role for you forever.
Yeah, you're right.
So all of these factors have pulled together and they've created this perfect storm of doubt. Can we take any stock in this? Is this believable? Because if this is just the invention of primitives and superstitious men, this book, if this is just their creation to explain the events of life based on their limited awareness, their limited scientific ability to grasp things, then we can surely throw this off. And if we can throw this off, we can rewrite the script for humanity's future in our image. And that's the humanist model. And I want to go back to the war thing for a moment, because we play a responsibility here. See, there's two questions that everybody has. The first is, how could man mistreat man? The second question is, how could a God who cares about men allow man to mistreat man? So how could good people who call themselves Christians abuse each other? And we can't write off all the acts of violence and horror and slaughter to the pagans and the heathens and the people who name God in name only but really don't follow God. We can't write it all off to them. Let's face it. We've committed our own atrocities. I mean, even in our own country, we've got a situation where for generations, people would go to church on Sunday morning and then go whip their slaves on Sunday afternoon. We know that to be true. And so people would question, is there any truth to any of this? We're going to take a break from this for a moment, and what I'd like you to do is turn over to 1 Peter. Alright, so when Peter writes this, Peter is writing to a group of people. Some are experiencing some persecution, some are not experiencing persecution. But here's the deal. There is a move afoot that is saying it's these Christians that are the problem. Now, I want to emphasize this because if this sounds remarkably similar to some of the situations and the words we hear today, it's because it kind of is. It's these Christians and their ways that are getting in the way of the progress of society. And if we could just eliminate them, if we could just demonstrate that Christians are the problem, we could remove them as a source of the difficulty and we could get on with our lives. Now we see this happening in our own country right now. And here is the disappointing fact. Many Christians have simply resorted. Many Christian groups, church groups, Christian parachurch organizations, they have resorted essentially to the same tactics that the world uses against us, and they just use it back. So we now have websites that post anti-Christian bigotry and go on and on at length about how our rights have been violated. And I'm not saying that they haven't been. Do you remember what Paul said about taking your problems to worldly courts? Is anybody familiar with that text? He says, why do you do that? He said, you make us a laughingstock out in the community. What you've said is you can't resolve your own problems. You can't learn how to live at peace with other people. And so instead you go to the very people that are going to persecute you and say, would you please solve our problem for us? And that's what we're doing in this country. Certain segments. So here's what Peter says. Guess I got to tell you where you need to be. Second chapter, 13th verse. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now before you get all anxious here, we'll read on to the end. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. And you can imagine what a shock that would have been to his readers to hear that. They're being oppressed. This is whether it is to the emperor supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. So as a word of encouragement, what I'd like you to do first is underline, if you'd like, the word ignorance. He's not saying that the practices of these people are intelligent. He's recognizing that there's a certain percentage of the population that's oppressing them and is just plain dumb. Where's the ignorance? He says, well, the ignorance at times is in the form of those who are in leadership, but the ignorance is also on the part of gullible people who really believe that it is the Christians who are the problem. And they themselves are ignorant because they've never bothered to sort out the facts for themselves, so they just trust the judgments of other people. Have you or I ever met people who think ill of Christians but really don't understand what Christians truly believe, what genuine Christ followers believe? Of course we have. And so in that sense, we could say they're ignorant, right? I wouldn't recommend that you go tell them they're ignorant. That probably wouldn't go well for the conversation. But so then he moves on. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom for as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. And so what he says to them, even in situations where they are under oppression, where what they believe is being challenged, where they are being singled out, and it is them that are being used as the scapegoat for some of the problems in society, he says, I want you to hold your heads high and live as free people. Know who you are, know whose you are. Make sure that you're believing solidly, but if you believe solidly, don't be intimidated, but honor everyone. Your role here is to be a servant of God. And he defines what that is. You are to be an example of what godly behavior looks like. You are to be an example. Remember what I said, that in the past 100 years there's been quite a bit of question, how could a divine being allow such pain and suffering? We are to be the answer to that. We are to give an example of what God's heart truly is. So if the people out there see us suing them, taking them to court, protesting things the same as the rest of it, what do they see that's any different? Absolutely nothing. We're just our own unique brand. And basically, let's call it what it is. We've just become sore losers because the other side now has the upper hand. And it's the first time that we don't have the upper hand. If you go back 50 years, we had the upper hand. We don't any longer. And now we sound like spoiled little kids that are sore losers, and we're going to take our problems to the court. And we're actually, as a group, followers of Christ in a lot of segments of the population are sounding more like spoiled kids. That's not what Peter says to do, and the situations are reasonably similar. It says, honor everyone. That means the guys you don't like, you still have to give honor to. Love the brotherhood. Are we doing that? Are we doing that really well? Are we caring for our own? Fear God and honor the emperor. Give recognition to the title. Are we doing that? Or do we look pretty much remarkably similar to the rest of culture? We just dress a little funny and go meet in a weird building once a week. Is that our distinctive? Is that what we're known for? Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect. Not only the good and the gentle, but also the unjust. For this is a gracious thing. Now, and think about this. How can you suffer when you are being mistreated? Where does the ability to do that come from? It is. And it really forces you to go back to what is supposed to be the source of your strength and encouragement. But instead, a lot of us go out the door every day unstrengthened, unencouraged, unsourced, and we go fight life in our own strength. I've done it, you've done it. Well, I don't know if you've done it, but I'm guessing maybe you've done it once or twice in your life. And how does that go? I'm not saying it goes bad, but you look just like everybody else. When you fight life on life's terms in your own strength, you look no different than anybody else. Verse 20, for what credit is it when you sin and are beaten, if you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example. Alright, so now we're going to jump down to the third chapter. Let me read verse 13 of the second chapter one more time. You just be ready at the start of chapter number 3. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now we go to chapter 3. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands. So what does that likewise have to do with? It's the exact same thing. He's actually referring back to verse 13 here of the previous chapter. In the same way, he's saying, wives, be subject to your own husbands. Boy, has this verse gotten some bad press over the years. Boy, has this verse been misapplied. Now, I want you to think about this. In the previous example where he says, be subject for the Lord's sake, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, is he saying that the emperor is a good guy? Necessarily? He's not preconditioning it. If the emperor is a nice guy, I want you to be subject to him. But if he's a real jerk and a schmuck and he's persecuting you, then I want you to start a revolt. So, chapter 3 again, and we could say, in the exact same way, wives, be subject to your own husbands, and that's own husbands. It doesn't say the male population as a whole. It doesn't say be a doormat for all males. It says, within a family structure, wives, I would like you to comport yourself to the, we'll say, rules of the house that your husband lays down. So that even if some of them do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Now here we move on to another contentious point. Verse 3, I guess it is. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry, or of the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. I really had to give some thought to that. Not because of the traditional arguments, but I wanted to see, is there anything more here that we need to look at that we don't quite understand? You know what bait and switch is? We do it in retail all the time. I think this is really what Peter is saying. Ladies, don't be bait and switch people. When the man that is going to marry you sees you and is drawn toward your attractiveness, but all the attractiveness is on the outside, and they really realize after the marriage that they have married a viper and not a thing of beauty, and that the viper is going to bite them, they feel as if they've made a bad deal. And so what he's really saying is, become on the inside who you're trying to portray yourself to be on the outside. Make sure that your inner person and your outer person are the same. Doesn't that make sense? I'm not even going to ask if anybody's been the victim of bait and switch. That would be bad practice. At the beginning of this, I encouraged you all to listen to this later on with your wife, your girlfriend, whatever. I think this is important. Because while it's true that every one of us is responsible for our own lives, and you've been told again and again that if you're in a bad relationship, that it's your responsibility to make it better, that relationship is going to be no better than the lowest common denominator. Now, I know there's people that would disagree with me, and that flies in the face of what you may even have been taught personally. But the relationship between you and your wife is going to be no deeper, no better than the lowest common denominator of commitment. That means if your wife is committed and you're not, it's going to find some aggregate middles closer to the bottom of your level of commitment than hers. If it's flipped and you're more committed than she, then it's going to be at that lower level. So the only way for relationships to work, and incidentally, what is society asking? Society's asking, is there any role for traditional marriage? Does this work? Can we point to any place in our country and say, that group's doing it right, let's go find out what they're doing? But the reality is that our marriages don't look a heck of a lot different in many cases than the marriages of everybody else. So why in the world would they come find out what we're doing? And so what I'm saying is, we both have to bring this to your wife. This is the job of the spiritual leader. You want to know what your role is? Sometimes your role is to do just this. All right. Verse number 7. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Okay, so again, a very contentious verse. What does it mean that women are the weaker vessel? Well, if you've been in the church for any length of time, I'm sure you've heard various explanations. The really cool thing about science is it starts to explain things in a way that you can then go back to the Bible and you can say, oh wow, that really makes sense. So when you don't understand the mechanics behind things, you follow God's word and you just trust God's word, and it's like, okay, it will go well for you. But when you do understand the mechanics behind the scenes and you look at it, it opens things up in a whole new way. So here's one of the things. Let's turn over to men and women at work. I've done a lot of talking and not much asking, like, does anybody have any questions or comments? So why don't we take a break for a moment and say, does anybody have any questions or comments? Is everybody awake? Everybody bored to tears, asking themselves why they came here this morning. Okay, holding your minds that idea, women, weaker vessel. We're going to read this together, men and women at work. Women can manage multiple projects better, but tend to get overwhelmed and burned out more quickly. And so here's what research says. Women, because they are confident that they can handle more things, willingly take on more things, and in the process of taking on more things, remember what we talked about, the World War II women? Go to work in the factory, go to work all day, come home. Ever hear that song about bringing home the bacon and fry it up in a pan? Okay, am I dating myself? I'm really dating myself. I know I'm dating myself. Half the men in the room don't even know what the song is. Okay, what's the point? The woman has become confident that she can manage these multiple things. If you had to say that there was one gender that was more frequently associated with crying and emotional meltdowns, would it be the man or the woman? Where does that come from? It comes from this right here. Because women tend to take on more stuff and are willing to try to keep more balls in the air at the same time and feel personal ownership of every one of those balls. What happens when the balls start to drop?
She feels unfair.
Yeah. I thought I could, but I can't. So when Peter talks about being a weaker vessel, can you imagine a man who does not quite understand this scientifically? And he watches women and the way they tend to melt down more quickly. Now, we might be quick to say, oh, well, that's why it's good to be a guy. Obviously, we don't melt down. It's good. Here's the problem. We as men tend to focus excellently on one thing at a time and can remain focused for longer periods of time. In other words, we can follow one project, one line of thinking, one task from beginning to end, and we have a tenacity and an endurance about us. What's the weak side to that? It's a tunnel vision. We can get so focused on the one thing. Have you ever been so absorbed in a project at work that you almost forget you have a home? Have you ever neglected your family to champion something at work? Or if the roles are reversed, have you ever championed something at home and neglected your responsibilities at work? See, while women tend to be able to own all of their responsibilities but melt under the pressure of dealing with them, men are extremely good at singling out one or two tasks, focusing on them for a long term, but they can start to get blinders on and be oblivious to everything else that's going on in their lives. Has your wife ever lectured you about how you don't seem to notice things? What are you laughing about, Ron?
I noticed. Sure, everybody's
Is there a role for both genders? Of course there is. But if you don't understand this stuff, what do you tend to assume? Women are obviously superior to men. Women can manage all these things. Men seem to be klutzes that can only do one thing at a time. Well, in a very practical sense, why would you put one-tool Harry in charge of something when you could put multi-tool Sally in charge of it and she'd get it all done? Just think about that. But when you don't understand the downside of each strength, you might tend to favor women. Here's another one. You're going to like this one. Women are more quickly expressive about perceived problems and are thus sometimes branded as whiners and complainers. So here's what it says. A man will tend to endure pain and difficulty and frustration for greater periods of time and not complain. And so the woman perceives him as being either insensitive or gutless or cowardly or fill in the blank. Yes. Was this a good comment or a Brian comment?
We're just obeying what Peter said in an understanding way.
Yes.
As they're beating on us and causing us pain.
Women, on the other hand, will be much quicker to express their frustration and complaint. Now, if you don't know this, what conclusions do you draw? I work next to two women all day long. And I'm telling you, this stuff is not imagination. This is not fanciful nothingness. This is like spot on stuff. Do you remember the way several months ago, might even be half a year ago by now, that we did that marriage thing and we talked about how when men solve problems and there's a big problem in front of them and a group of men are put to solving the problem, that they break the problem down into individual components, that assignments are delegated and each man goes and does his own thing by himself, whereas women tend not to have an authority figure and they all just go together and solve the problem together? I'm telling you, I see that lived out every day in front of me. And I do try to suffer in silence. And it's not easy some days. And I am much more expressive than most men probably should be. And it does not go well sometimes. I'm just saying. Are you judging me? But suppose that you don't know this. And suppose your wife doesn't know this. Suppose that your wife thinks you are the only schmuck that just sits there and plods along and suffers in silence. And she thinks that other men are more normal and healthy because the only other base of comparison she has is herself. And she sees the problem and she's free to complain about it. So obviously any thinking person would complain. And she doesn't know that it's not you, it is the gender. And suppose that you think that you are married to the only shrew in existence and no other woman on the planet complains as much as she does. Just suppose that you thought that way for a moment. Would that change your understanding if you realized that this is just the nature of women to express themselves about a problem more? And not all women, just the same as not all men, are equally gifted in effective expression? Suppose your wife was just being the woman that God created her to be. She just didn't quite have all the tools to express things in the best way, the most advantageous way. And so it came out sounding a little bit more like grumbling and whining than just recognizing a problem and wanting to deal with it. But if nobody in the household knows that this is the dynamic that's taking place, what do you think is going to happen? While the male suffers in silence and the woman goes yap, 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 yap. Okay, is this going to be a Brian comment or a good comment?
I would also tend to say that when men and women don't recognize each other's strengths and weaknesses, they tend to polarize even more. So whereas a woman early in marriage will be pointing out a problem and attempting to get her husband to work together to fix it, the husband is not going to recognize that and work with her. That will quickly over the years degenerate into whining and complaining, which is the same attribute, just unrecognized. So when strengths are not recognized, it degenerates into something less than what it could be.
And so in a way, what he's saying is, if a little, he didn't say it quite like this, but what he's saying is, if a little whining didn't produce the desired effect, there's more where that came from. And if being quiet and staying in the house didn't produce the desired effect that you wanted, then you know where the door is and you're not afraid to use it. All right. So we're going to move into the realm of parenting. Because this is challenging enough between two people who get married and they haven't had kids yet. But kids really change the dynamic of everything. So, I don't know how long any of you was married before you had kids. You taking off? Okay, see ya. Have a good day. But think about this for just a little bit with me. The man provides a minimal contribution to the birth of the child. It's basically the fun part. And then for the next 9 months, the woman has to be the incubator for this child that she carries around within her. So who do you think starts out being closer to the child? It's a default thing. The woman is closer to the child. And then, for the most part, y'all have kids? Some of you have kids? How many of you breastfed your kids? Yeah, right. Okay, now put your hand down. I don't want to know. You know, they actually make things like that for men to be able to comfort the... Yeah, that's really weird. We're not going there. You just zip it, buddy. The woman is more heavily invested in and attached to the child at the beginning. Now, I want you to see a critical dynamic that's taking place here. Where's the child raised? In the home. And so very quickly, the woman who before shared a residence with a guy and the two of you had fun there, the two of you did stuff there, it was your base camp for going out and doing useful and interesting things in the world, and you came home and the home was your joint domain. But now this is like this three-way thing going on, and now what is the home? The home is the primary place of safe haven for this child. The child that you contributed a little bit of sperm to and she contributed 9 months of her life to and is now feeding every day. And so there's this gradual transformation that takes place. It's like, have you ever felt as if your home was no longer your home? There's a reason for that. And so again, we come back to this changing gender roles and struggling with this. Remember what I said before, there was a time when man was 100% provider and the woman looked after the home, but now we have a situation where, and this is as sociologists, even secular ones, admit it, the man provides 50% of the income and becomes a surrogate to the wife who bosses the husband around and tells the husband what to do to take care of the kids. And a man doesn't know how to deal with it, and he doesn't deal with it well. And a lot of men end up practicing that they know where the door is thing. And so what will happen is a man will become distant. They don't understand what's happened. Because for a period of time now, the woman will start to place the needs of the child above the needs of what before had been the most interesting person in her life, her husband. Pretty soon the husband is a third-rate addition, useful for taking out the garbage and maybe changing the diapers if she's busy. Now, I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but this is clearly what happens in a lot of homes. And in a situation like that, the woman, I believe, doesn't even understand how the dynamic has changed. Remember, she's keeping multiple balls in the air at the same time. She's at her wit's end. She's barely able to keep all the balls in the air at the same time. And you come home and you're a guy and you've got one thing on your mind and it's not changing diapers and it doesn't have anything to do with the kid. And the woman in your life is like so consumed with everything else in her life that she's ready to have a meltdown. And so what do you become? Huh? Yeah, well, yes, you do. But you see the way she starts to think about you. You've got a one-track mind. You're barely useful for earning an income. As a matter of fact, before I had kids, I had to go out and help you earn the income that we needed to live on. And now I've got to take care of this kid most of the time. Here's what they've discovered. Again, men and women interact with children differently. They say by the time a child is 2 months old, they understand the difference between interacting with men and interacting with women. So if a child is raised in a home with only a mom, a child doesn't get the benefit of interacting with men. Would you wish that on your children growing up? And again, we're coming back to this roles and identities and what is our value. Because I told you that I hope by the end of this time this would be very encouraging for you and you would understand you have a role to play. Do not quit because it's frustrating. You have a valuable role to play and your kids will not be the kids that they could be or should be if you give up. And when I say give up, I don't necessarily mean walk out the door, but what I mean is become disengaged. Because that's the greater temptation in the church. It's not for a guy to give up and walk out the door. It's for the guy to become detached from his family and find all of his meaning and significance somewhere else, outside the home. And I won't even bother to ask because I don't think there's anybody who hasn't identified with that. Let's, for the last couple of minutes, turn over to the back page. And I know you're going to laugh. That we're going to look at Dr. Phil. It was actually some pretty good advice. So, yeah, you can go home and tell your wife that you all studied Dr. Phil today. That's great. We're just going to read these. A provider. Most men believe that being a good provider means supporting a family financially. But, and this is the transition, if you want to be a man of the 21st century that is going to have a meaningful impact on your family and on this culture, here's what he says, it means much more than that. A man should also contribute to the emotional, spiritual, physical, and mental well-being of his family. In order to do this, he must recognize that there are other currencies in addition to money that need to be provided. So just think about that for a moment. What are the other things besides money that your family needs? And if you want reason to get into God's Word and get in the company of other men and study how to do this more effectively, this is all the reason you need. A protector. And this one, to me, was personally convicting. This means more than beating up the guy next door if he insults your wife. It means protecting her self-esteem and self-worth as well as your children's. It can also mean protecting your way of life and guarding against any threats to the things that you and your family value. So what would it mean to... How many guys do you know that would say they would send their wives and children to church? Right, we know that that used to be very common. Here's what he's saying in a spiritual context. You be the guy that intentionally gathers your herd together and brings them to church and discusses throughout the week the things that you're learning. They're not going to get it anywhere else. A leader, instead of waiting for your wife to take the initiative when you're having problems, take the lead. Now, you know what happens to the person who sticks his head up in the fight, right? That's the person who gets shot. But this is exactly what we're asking to have happen. Even though it risks further controversy, what he's saying here is, at the right time, in the right way, you take the initiative. If there's a problem between the two of you and you wait for your wife to bring it up, or you have that old stalemate, the Mexican standoff, where the first person to talk loses. You know what I'm talking about? Maybe you don't know what I'm talking about. Hey, that's not demonstrating leadership. And I know that it can be, well, what do you say? What do you say that is meaningful? What do you say that doesn't just escalate the problem? What do you say that diffuses the problem? This is part of why we need each other. This is part of why we need intergenerational discipline. I'll say this right now. This is why the time for guys to get involved in something like this is starting in their late teens, even before you get married. And it's why, even if you're 60 or 70, you're needed in a group like this. For the wisdom that you have. For the experiences that you've had. At very least, you can share with other men what didn't work well. We all have a pretty long list of those things. The things in our lives that didn't work well, don't do this again. And finally, as a teacher. And remember, this is the role of a man. What are you teaching those around you, especially your children? And with your behavior. It's important to provide a good example for your children, your loved ones, and your community. And so in that sense, I'd say, if you want your kids to be servants, if you want your kids to have a heart for people around the world, if you want your kids to do this, how do you give them that? You show them that. You take them places. You do things with them. You let them see that you have a heart for the things around you. So I guess we can wrap this up by saying that your role is no less important than it has ever been. That your kids, your wife, your church, the people around you will be poorer if you disengage. Much poorer. In ways that they will never understand. See, if something has been missing your whole life, and this is the challenge, if you were raised by a single parent, you don't understand what the other parent didn't provide because you've never experienced it. And so you don't know what's missing from your life. So what I'm asking all of us to do is stay engaged, and I'm trying to give you the encouragement by saying, your role does matter. Don't give up. All right. We are...